in Itown Arena, The Worst Person in the World, Broadcast Signal Intrusion and River are the movies up for review, and fiddle player Martin Hayes on the music mix that is Common Ground Ensemble. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Tonight on our Thursday night film reviews, is she a psychologist? Is she a photographer? Or is she an idealised version of an older Norwegian man's perfect 30-something Norwegian woman? It was a hit at Cannes, but it won multi-Oscar nominated Worst Person in the World. Will it be a hit on Arena this evening? We shall see. That's not all. We'll consider River, visually stunning documentary narrated by the vocally stunning Willem Dafoe, and we'll also talk about Broadcast Signal Intrusion, an indie horror film which sends its grieving hero down a road of VHS tape facilitated paranoia. Tara Brady and Justin McGregor are with me this evening to talk about all three. We'll start with The Worst Person in the World from Joachim Trier. He was a guest on the programme on Monday night, in fact. This is a film about Julie, a woman on the verge of 30, caught between two men, in fact, and she's also trying to find some meaning in her own life along the way. Up for awards in the Best International Film category and Best Original Screenplay, and its star, Renate Reinsve, won Best Actress at Cannes last summer. So let's start with that one. First of all, Tara, the character of Julie, just tell us where she is in her, it has to be said, very eventful life. Certainly in the first maybe 2 minutes of the film, she goes through an awful lot of events and careers.
Yeah, well, it's worth noting that the film is told in chapters, which allows the film to sort of jump it from thing to thing, much in the way that Julie jumps from thing to thing. But as it opens, she's this indecisive 20-something-year-old student who starts off and she's studying medicine, and then she changes her major and she wants to be a psychologist, and then she's a photographer, and then she meets this cartoonist who's, I suppose, the best way of describing him is he's like some sort of cool underground cartoonist who does something like Fritz the Cat, but a 21st century version. His name is Axel, and he's played by Trier regular Anders Danielsson-Lee, who's a tremendous actor. He's a little bit older than she is, and he warns her right from the start that, you know, that they're at different points in their life and they're maybe going to want different things, and maybe he's going to want children and she's not going to be ready for them, and that this is going to be a difference that's going to come between them, and sure enough that does happen. And then the second man enters the picture, a man called Elvind, played by Herbert Nordrum, and he's like Julie. He's like, because she's working out her stuff and she's in a bookstore and she's sometimes writing, and he's a barista, and you know, he isn't keen on settling down either, so you know, so they sort of come together. So there's these two opposing men in her life, I suppose, defining her all the time.
I suppose in some ways, Justin, it's a kind of a classic rom-com setup here. Is that the area we're in, or does it go to other places?
Yeah, when it starts, it does this, as you say, this amazing sort of first 2 minutes of all the transitions that Julie's going through. But then it actually becomes really very earnest and kind of serious and sincere, which are actually very hard to do, you know, without it becoming, you know, maudlin or anything like that. But it actually really looks at somebody who's, you know, youth is left behind, but adulthood hasn't arrived yet, you know, but it's not by choice. It's not arrested development. You know, for her, it's like she really doesn't know what that next step is. Like when they talk about children, Axel says, you'll be a great mother. She doesn't even know if she wants kids, you know, and she's really sort of figuring all that stuff out. And we're really kind of rooting for her to work through it.
When you look at this character, however, Tara, I suppose, you know, maybe you would explain for those who don't know what a manic pixie dream girl is, what a manic pixie dream girl is, and tell me, is Julie one of those?
She very, very much is. A manic pixie dream girl, I suppose the classic manic pixie sexy dream girl in cinema is Melanie Griffith in Jonathan Demme's Something Wild. But, you know, she's the girl who comes in and blows the cobwebs off the fusty old hero, and suddenly he's on an adventure or a road trip or some kind, or he's running away from Ray Liotta, or he's on some kind of crazy adventure. And the kind of really good idea here is that it's a manic pixie dream girl narrative, but told from the pixie perspective. I think where it comes a cropper is that there's, and you can argue the case that yes, Julie's kind of faffing around and she hasn't really found herself yet, but she's not really a particularly deep character in her own right. She's very much defined by the men in her life, sometimes her father, we shall say. And there are various chapters we see that aren't really filled in. And I know there was originally a kind of 4-hour cut of this movie. Yeah. And some things remain sort of frustratingly out of view in terms of defining her. And it's worth mentioning as well, without sort of spoiling anything, sort of the kind of entire last act where she has to sort of grow up a little bit isn't really her story. It's somebody else's
it's somebody
story.
Else's and her story.
Bouncing
yeah.
off it.
Yeah, and illness comes into play that it kind of shocked me, certainly, in watching the film. Mm-hmm. But just, I'll stay with you on this one, because we mentioned this idea, you said it earlier on, Tara, you know, in that very opening scene when the older character Axel says to her, you know, look, you're at a different place in your life, mm-hmm. I'm at a different, we should leave it be, let's just part friends and leave it at that. And she walks out the door, and then there's this moment, and that was the moment I fell in love with him. And my heart dropped a bit when I heard that, because I thought, oh, is she going to be defined totally in terms of those relationships?
Yeah, and she kind of is. I mean, I don't want to come down too hard on the film, because I think one of the things that Trier, like I'm a fan of Trier's work generally, but one of the things, and he works generally with this guy, Eskil Voigt, and one of the things they do brilliantly is they build scenes from the bottom up, like these little concept scenes. And you can take the chapters in the movie, and some of them are absolutely brilliant short films. The film where Elvind and Julie first get together is a brilliant. It's such a brilliant little short film in its own right, where she meets him and she's crashed this wedding, and they have this conversation, and they cheat but don't cheat. It's such a great idea. It's a lovely meet cute.
Yeah, it is that meet cute, but it's not the only thing that they do, Justin, in terms of what Trier does here cinematically. There's another sequence. Explain the freeze sequence, which it involves. It's a wonder, like time is frozen for just a split second. Explain how that happens. It's not a split second. It's frozen for about 30 seconds, maybe. Maybe a minute.
Yeah, no, there's just an amazing moment where he really likes this scene in his other movies too, where he has the character traveling kind of alone through the city. But here he kind of twists it, where time freezes and everything stops in the apartment, and she goes out and she starts heading over to where Elvind works, and all the people of Oslo.
So she's in one boyfriend's apartment and she stops time and heads off to the other guy.
She's kind of ending it with him and then heads off through Oslo, and everyone else is frozen. And it's a really great use of CGI. There's people on bikes, people sort of, you know, throwing things, all these things are going on, and it's almost like a kind of musical number as she finds him. Yeah. And of course, when she gets to the coffee shop, he's still moving, you know, and he can kind of join her in this moment.
Of course, the whole world is frozen except the two lovers. How else would it be? So we're not in a world of realism here, Justin.
No, we're not.
No, because time doesn't freeze like that in real life. Let's be clear.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's part of sort of the shifting perspectives, like that, you know, she's the protagonist, but then there are these moments where she kind of hands the story over. And like Tara says, you know, the way the chapters work, and some of them are frustratingly short. I mean, some of them are like 8 or 9 minutes, and then some of them are like 2.5. Mm. And you do feel like something, a thought hasn't been finished. But it really is kind of this idea of what is the world, and how do we construct it and see it and find our place in it.
It did strike me that maybe that's part of it, because there were parts of this film that I thought were great, parts of it that irritated me enormously. Is it that mix between, in one section, we're not in a world of realism at all, we're in this kind of, you know, time freezes literally so that you can run from one lover to the other. And then in other parts, we're dealing with a very serious illness and somebody facing their own mortality. That mix is hard to carry off, Tara.
Yeah, and I think there are scenes that definitely do just sound like with a big clang on the floor. I didn't get on at all with the magic mushroom scene. It seemed to like just wander in entirely from a different film.
Yeah, a group of friends are eating magic mushrooms, and they all get very high and various hallucinatory happenings.
It also has a very pat idea of like what young women are afraid of. It's very much like what women are afraid of as written by two men. There are a few moments like that during the film. I also do think there's certainly, and you know, we've touched on this already, the denouement, like, I'm not sure it's entirely earned. It feels sort of grafted on, and it doesn't feel crucially or organic to her story. And I kept thinking about sort of film, certain projects that have been like very, very big hits with women over the last number of years, like Fleabag, and crucial part of the appeal of those things is that they're written by women for women. And I was reminded a lot as well of Noam Baumbach's Frances Ha, and I kept thinking about what that would have been like if it wasn't co-written by Greta Gerwig, makes a huge difference.
Yeah, because I did ask Joachim Trier that on Monday night, the idea that he was a 45-year-old woman writing a 45-year-old man writing a 30-year-old woman's perspective, as well as one of the characters who's a 45-year-old man, but he seemed to be quite happy that he was writing a character. And as a man, it was hard for me to argue the woman's point of view, obviously. Tara would be much, much more au fait with that particular situation. Overall, did it work for you, Justin?
Yeah, I mean, I did not like chapter 11. That really seemed kind of added on. There was enough going on.
Is chapter
there.
11, is that the magic mushroom scene?
No, I think that's chapter 7.
What was chapter 11?
Chapter 11 is everything must come to an end.
Oh, right. So that's the denouement type of feel.
Yeah. And I really didn't like that. But just overall, I really like, I don't know, my 20s and 30s, they felt very fragmented. I really identified with her, but from a female perspective, like I know those things are there, but I didn't bother me. Like I really identified with that fragmented nature of, you know, what I felt like at 28, 29.
But we would have to accept it didn't bother me either, but we're both men.
Yeah.
I think they bother Tara, and that's fair enough. Stars from you on this one, Justin.
Yeah, as I say, doing Sincere, I think, is really hard, and it grabbed me. I turned it on. I wasn't sure if I was going to have time to watch the whole thing. I went way past my bedtime, watched it to the very end. It just grabbed me, didn't let me go. So I would give it 5 stars.
A full 5?
Yeah, I loved it.
You're saying there's nothing wrong with it then?
No, chapter 11.
Well,
4.5.
Okay, I'm beating you down. All right, Tara, I don't think you're quite in that category on this one.
No. I definitely don't. I think there's just parts of it didn't really work for me as a female viewer. But I did have fun. I mean, it bounces along. I mean, and even the episodic thing, you know, even the episodes that don't work, the great thing is there'll be another chapter along in a minute. I'll go soft 4, but, you know, soft, like somewhere between 3.5 and 4.
Right, okay. So there are annoying sections, but there are great sections too. It seems to be, if I'm not putting words in your mouth on that particular one, that's what we're talking about in the most annoying person in the world. Am I giving the right correct title? The worst person in the world. There you go. That's the correct title. Let us move on then to River. Visually ambitious, it would have to be said. Documentary feature from Australian filmmaker Jennifer Peedham, written by Robert McFarlane, who we've spoken about to on this show, in fact. The narration here is by Willem Dafoe, and the score from composer, including the man of the moment, Johnny Greenwood. This is about Rivers, Justin.
Yes.
What does it tell us about Rivers?
Well, it goes through, it looks at them historically, it looks at them as you know, I think the first line is, when the first rains fell, the rivers began, or something to that effect.
I thought it was almost like a little section from the Bible. It had that biblical feel off it.
It did. At times it had a really kind of religious and quasi-religious language about it. And that goes back, as I then kind of explain, about, you know, the worship of rivers and the way settlements grew around them. And, you know, nations emerged from, or nation states certainly emerged from these rivers. And then it kind of gets into the, you know, the late 19th and 20th century, and us beginning to manipulate rivers with dams and rerouting them and removing them. And they kind of show us, they show us some of that being undone, but they never really kind of go into the specifics of, you know, damage that's sometimes done when that happens. It's just kind of sort of inferred. And then it's all of that is filmed, very ambitiously, very much like Planet Earth. You know, lots of slow-mo.
The David Attenborough series.
The Attenborough series, with lots of kind of slow-mo splashing and waves and waterfalls and some beautiful stuff from space, from kind of near space of river deltas and what have you.
And while we don't have David Attenborough's voice, which is beautiful and soothing, we do have Willem Dafoe's voice. Let's listen to a clip which gives us a sense of how the music and the voice really play off each other. the visuals are stunning to watch as you're listening to this as well.
To be truly alive, a river must be wild. Willful and unhindered. Yearning for the ocean, its only purpose is to descend.
So there we go, a little clip there from River featuring a wonderful score, original music from Johnny Greenwood, other music in there as well, but the voice of Willem Dafoe. To be true to itself, to be true to life, a river must be wild, yearning to the ocean, its only purpose is to descend. We're not getting deep thoughts around rivers. It had a fairly cliched feel to it, and it's quite generalised, the script around this description of rivers, Tara.
Yeah, I wasn't really sure what it was trying to do. Because, you know, as Justin mentioned, yeah, there's a little bit of history and there's some great shots from space. You have an incredible sort of ensemble involved, like Willem Dafoe's like beautiful voice, and you have this fantastic music, and you've Bach and you've Vivaldi on top of Johnny Greenwood. I'm sure they're glad to be in that company, and you have like you have all this exquisite editing, and you have this daredevil cinematography, and it's all kind of lovely. But I wasn't at all sure about the voiceover. I mean, it's sometimes poetic and it's very very repetitive. But it's almost not poetic enough, and it'll touch on things like the environment or like climate, but it never really goes there. It never actually gets into any proper environmental argument. And I felt it would be better if it was sort of done like a poetic montage, the way like Baraka or Koyaanisqatsi or one of those films where you are like just relying on the photography to make the argument
and the music,
rather than a voiceover.
Yeah, because it also struck me, Justin, that the way this film starts is we see the orchestra getting into place as the opening credits are happening, and we see Willem Dafoe, you know, standing in front of the microphone and getting his headphones on and saying a few words in and yum, 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 getting his voice going, all that. You know, do I really need to see that? You know, it did feel like, P.S., we got Willem Dafoe here to do the narration. Did we need that at the beginning?
No, I don't know if they were going for some kind of like meta thing, you know, that like, oh, just in case you should know an orchestra play.
They were showing us the money.
They were showing us what they spent, possibly. But yeah, it was sort of an odd, and it starts black and white, with that, and we see Willem Dafoe, and then they end with that singer there, Johnny Burton, I think it is, and they end with that, and I'm not quite sure why that's there, and there's a lot of those pieces I'm not quite sure why they're there, and I really wanted it to land a punch. I mean, Tara's right. Like, I was thinking of Koyaanisqatsi and Powakwatsi, and what they do with images. This is like 1982. This is 40 years ago. They really kind of nailed this kind of life being out of balance, and it would have been great to see a real kind of take on the river that way. But instead, it becomes lots of metaphors, you know, on the banks of life and that kind of thing, and it just sort of. It says nothing, you know. It's only when it gets super specific, I feel, that it has little moments.
Yeah, and it really only, I don't know if it actually specifically gives the specific name of even one river throughout all of this. And there are several dams that we see, but we're never told, given the name of the dams. Only when it talks about dams, Tara, does it really kind of get into any kind of specifics about how man interfering with the environment causes huge problems. But that's for about 5 minutes. Apart from that, it's quite general.
Yeah, you get something about dams, and you get sort of this little monochrome photography from years ago. But yeah, there's no context to it, and also like dams aren't always terrible things. I mean, it's just sort of sitting there without comment. You know, it's a very kind of strange thing to have when there are plenty of other climate related things that you could parachute in there that could be. I think part of the problem is that this is one of those kind of big sensual visual exercises that they used to make for IMAX cinemas, and IMAX cinemas now show Batman, and and that's great. It's great to see Batman on the big screen, but the problem is that now these kind of films have nowhere really to go. So they have to kind of, I suppose dress them up and drag in Willem Dafoe and put him in black and white and get the Australian, chamber orchestra to sort of fire up their instruments and give it this kind of sense of ceremony in order to make it a little bit grander. But yeah, it sort of seems to be something that should be on 70 mil print on a very, very large screen.
It doesn't sound as if it worked for either of you. Stars from you and final comment, Justin.
You know, I think it's worthy. I hope that they were trying to sort of, move discussions on rivers and dams sort of along. So just for the cinematography, I did give it 3 stars. There was some wonderful stuff from space, and the music is really amazing. But it really needed a lot more depth than it would have been a real wow.
Yeah, and Jennifer Peedham, I mean, she did give us Mountain and Sherpa, where she was much more specific in those films, I think, Tara, but she's not specific here. Is that the ultimate problem?
Yeah, that is the ultimate problem. That, and I think the voiceover. I don't think the voiceover really knows where it is. But I'm happy to give it 3. It looks beautiful.
Yeah, and the music is stunning. And the music and the visuals would have done it for me too. So there you go, for what it's worth. Let's move on then to Broadcast Signal Intrusion, an American indie horror flick that plays upon the ever so 1980s concept of mysterious masked person interrupting this broadcast. It would be amazing now if something did happen. That somebody. Now they've lost us. They're now seeing some masked figure on the internet as if they're watching us. Nefarious intentions, presumably. Let's start with you, Justin, on the setup. I think there's some kind of very tenuous link to real life here, isn't there?
Yeah,
in Chicago,
and mainly in the first kind of 2/3. Yeah, no, in the 80s there was a broadcast signal got hijacked, pirated, and there was a kind of Max Headroom figure who went on a bit of a rant, and that's a federal crime, but it was never solved. They never found out anything who did it, and so Phil Drinkwater and Tim Waddle, who are the writers here, they'd done a short film that they also directed, kind of on this, and this has gotten spun into a feature film. But here, to give it a bit more depth, we have this character James, played really well by Harry Shum Jr. His wife Hannah has gone missing 3 years previously. We don't know, maybe she killed herself, maybe she was abducted, we don't know. He's filled with grief, he's working late at night transferring VHS to DVD, and he comes across their fictionalized version of this real life event, and becomes obsessed with finding out what does it mean, while of course he's really looking for meaning in his own life.
I suppose, Tara, that is the essential story here, is the dilemma that we're trying to solve as a viewer, or I was trying to solve, was is James here, is it grief that has him, if you like, inventing these events, or did these events really happen, and can we explain them?
Well, I mean, only a few weeks ago, I think the three of us were talking about here before, and that idea that, like, it's one of those horror films that people go, it's not really a horror film, it's about grief. And that's become a real theme, I suppose, of recent horror films. There's also the Masters, a new film out recently, and then it's like, it's not really about horror, it's about racism. And this is very much about how grief can kind of twist the mind. And the film really plays with that, and leads you down this rabbit hole to an extent that you're not even sure that the people who are involved in this conspiracy, like, are they even real people? Or are they figments of his imagination? I mean, it's very nicely done. I mean, on a budget, they do something that approximates Alan J. Pakula's paranoia trilogy, Parallax View and All the President's Men, and that kind of really shadowy, like, paranoid aesthetic, which I think is remarkable. And it does, and even little details details, like the mask is really creepy. Like they, and the lo-fi stuff works really well because as we all know, like one of the big sort of things of modern horror films is that, you know, you have to have this scene early in the horror film where your mobile phone doesn't work. So those are out of the equation and the internet is out of the equation. So you have this kind of old school kind of gumshoe type figure trying to do an investigation down a rabbit hole. Yeah. And Harry Shum Jr. is absolutely fantastic. Yeah, it's an absolute revelation.
Let's listen to Harry Shum Jr. in one of the scenes. He's talking to Chris Sullivan here, the Freaker, who, as you say, is one of these kind of potential rabbit holes that he's heading down trying to find out. And we're not sure whether the Freaker is telling us the truth or Harry Shum or James, the character, is imagining this. But here's the discussion that's going on between the two of them.
The numbers. The code. All of it. It was my idea. Figured if I hit it well enough, planted a little seed on the boards, people would go nuts. So, a week before we stole the signal, I gathered up all the money they paid me. I took a bus to Peoria, and I set up shop. And I waited. You have no idea how long I waited.
What was that?
That is no concern of yours.
That is no concern of yours, and it's going to be no concern of the viewers who are watching broadcasting Alien Intrusion either. That's one of the rabbit holes that you go down. There's several of them. That does this work as a film overall? What? Because there's some great things about it. Again, it looks great, but there are problems too.
No, I mean, Tara's right. There's this feeling like that you are watching something like All the President's Men or The Conversation or something, and it's all really starting to go somewhere until it starts to go everywhere and nowhere sort of all at the same time. Like that scene where someone confesses, you know, it's followed by a confrontation with a different character. You don't know if they know each other. You never find out what the banging is upstairs. And then there's a final scene that is just inexplicable, that doesn't wrap anything up, doesn't give you any clues. You know, you're not going to leave the theater with questions. You're going to leave with a grievance. Like, why did you end it this way?
Stars.
Look, yeah, it's a great mood on a low budget. The acting is spectacular, but I just couldn't go above two.
All right. What are you saying, Tara?
I go 3.5.
3.5 from Tara. That's Justin McGregor, Tara Brady, speaking to us this evening about The Worst Person in the World, which is on general release. River, which is showing at the IFI, and Broadcast Signal Intrusion, which is on limited release and on digital platforms. This weekend, Martin Hayes and the Common Ground Ensemble take to the stage of the National Concert Hall in Dublin. Martin, of course, one of our most internationally acclaimed musicians, fated for his fiddle playing and for his collaborations with Chicago guitarist Dennis Cahill and with the Irish-American supergroup The Gloaming. The Common Ground Ensemble is the latest band he's put together, features Cormac McCarthy on piano, Kate Ellis on cello, Kyle Sana on guitar and Brian Donnellan on bouzouki, harmonium and concertina. Delighted to be joined by Martin Hayes, who's joining us from Spain, I do believe, this evening, Martin. But do you know what I'm going to ask you to do? First of all, I want you to imagine yourself back home because I want to listen to the Maharabon reel. Listening to this will bring you back home. Just introduce it for us, will you?
Well, it's a reel that I remember from my childhood that Joe Bann and Bill Malley, this fiddle player and tin whistle player duet from the townland of Maharabon, used to play. It was kind of, so this tune is quite rhythmic and pulsy, but they played it in a kind of a rhythmic way as well. It was a tune for house dances once upon a time, but it's got a little slightly different take now.
Right, well, this is the Common Ground Ensemble version of the Maharabon reel. Thank you. the Maharabon Reel, or a section of it, as played by Martin Hayes and his Common Ground Ensemble. Martin, as I said, joining us from Spain this evening. Does that bring you back all the way back home, Martin, when you hear it?
Well, more or less, yeah, yeah. I suppose nearly all the tunes I play kind of bring me home at this stage. You know, they're all they're all from that well, I suppose. You know,
but yeah. Interesting. You were talking about the way you might have heard that tune when you were younger, but particularly when the piano comes in just in that last section there, it goes off into a slightly different set of rhythms, maybe from the straightforward reel dance that's at its very heart. That's Cormac McCarthy on piano, bringing his kind of jazz influence in some ways, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's a really wonderful jazz pianist, and that track wouldn't even really show the much of the extent of his playing, you know, like, because he really does kind of open up on a number of the other pieces that we play. But he's an amazing player, as is, you know, they all are, really. Kyle and Kate and Brian, they're all just great players, you know, so it's a pleasure to play with them, you know.
Yeah, Kate Ellis, the artistic director of the Crash Ensemble, Kyle Sana, a guitar collaborator with Edgar Meyer, Chris Teal, people like that, and Brian Donnell, and then, I suppose, a little bit closer to home, the Tullagh Cayley Band, an alumna of their bouzouki, harmonium, concertina. Casting a band like this, I suppose, is where it's at its most important, getting those influences all together. How patient do you have to be in the room to just let the mix find the right level of how each ingredient will work, Martin?
Well, you don't have to be all that patient, because you know, if you pick the right people in the first place, you know, like, I actually, it's more like I sit back in amazement sometimes and watch, you know, really, you know, high functioning musicians, like, making choices and decisions in on the fly. But I mean, it starts out with kind of a basic kind of palette of ideas, like, that I will kind of lay on the table to begin with, you know, kind of basic chord outlines and basic rhythm ideas and arrangement ideas. But I never want to, like, well, I wouldn't really be capable of it, but I never want to kind of, you know, imagine writing parts for people in a very specific kind of way. I like to kind of give people a kind of a framework and then let them work within that, you know, and that's how it works, you know.
Yeah, and also at the National Concert Hall, because tomorrow night and Saturday night at the Concert Hall, isn't it?
It's Saturday and Sunday.
I beg your pardon, Saturday and Sunday. You'd be a bit relaxed, I suppose, to be sitting in Spain tonight if you're in the Concert Hall tomorrow night. Denver, the Shannon singer, will be there, and harpist, and David Power on Illan Pipe. So that'll bring quite a dynamic into the mix as well.
Yeah, well, David will actually only be there for the Sunday night, but Sheila will be there both nights, you know. So, and I've worked with both of them quite a lot before, so they'll, you know, they fit right in. And I always, like, no matter how far out we go with the music, I like the fact that we can have, like, some honest to goodness Shannos and some really, really just solid Illan piping, you know, so that will keep us grounded no matter what happens, I think, you know.
You played Dubai on St. Patrick's Day, the National Concert Hall tomorrow, on Saturday and Sunday, as you say, and then you're on tour in the US in April. The normality of getting back and getting the music out on the road, you must be delighted and happy to be back in that place, Martin.
Well, I am, yeah. I mean, it was a long wait. I mean, these two concerts were we were, like, I think a day away from performing 2 years ago when we had the shutdown. And so, you know, it's been a long way to kind of get back out there. And it's not just for me, but for musicians all over. And I suppose, you know, I suppose performance artists, like, you know, in particular, have been shut down for a solid 2 years. But it's certainly great to get back, that's for sure.
You very kindly have given us an exclusive play of The Boyne Water, which is one of the tracks, I guess, that people will hear in the concert hall. This is a Michael Russell tune. Maybe you'd introduce to us to this as we finish up, Martin.
Well, yeah, it was just a tune that I heard Michael Russell play, and I kind of looked it up, and it was called The Boyne Water. And I don't know, I was talking to somebody else about it then, and they go, oh yeah, you know, that's actually an Orange marching tune as well. And I love the fact that this melody, like, doesn't know any borders whatsoever and doesn't know any political divide, you know, and that Michael Russell was just as happy playing it as a bunch of other people might be marching along with a lambeg drum playing it, you know. But anyway, this is our version of it, so.
Great to speak with you, Martin, and good luck with the two concerts coming up. We'll give people details again, but in the meantime, let's listen to this version of Michael Russell's The Boyne Water from the Common Ground Ensemble. Lovely the way they open up that piece of music for us. That's the Michael Russell tune, The Boyne Water, as played by the Common Ground Ensemble. The Common Ground Ensemble will be at the National Concert Hall in Dublin Saturday the 26th, Sunday the 27th of March, and further details on nch.ie. Inspired by the best-selling historical romance novels of Julia Quinn, the Netflix series Bridgerton follows the 8 close-knit siblings of the powerful Bridgerton family as they attempt to find love and ultimately themselves in Regency London's high society. The second season of Bridgerton, available on Netflix from tomorrow, follows Lord Anthony Bridgerton as he sets out to find a suitable wife. Across Grosvenor Square, the Featheringtons must welcome the newest heir to their estate, while Penelope, our own Nicola Coughlan, of course, continues to navigate the town whilst keeping her deepest secret from the people closest to her. Joined by Jen Gannon this evening, who has been watching season two for us. But before we get stuck into season two, Jen, maybe for those who have been living under a non-Regency rock, you might remind us the dark days of 2020 when Bridgerton first hit Netflix. I mean, it was such a successful series at that point in time. Why do you think it made such an impact? I mean, what was it about that setup that we get?
I mean, it was massive. It came out on Christmas Day 2020 and so many people were looking forward to it. And I think it's because it's in that kind of familiar, almost Austen-esque world. Mm. And it's Shonda Rhimes, so you know you're going to get something very dramatic and glamorous. And she really kind of took from, I think, Sofia Coppola's groundbreaking Marie Antoinette. She pulled a lot from that, those kind of anachronistic sensibilities. And it was it was effortlessly diverse. And I think a lot of people talked about the colour blindness. It became this huge focal point. It was a massive masterclass in casting, and it really showed up that insular whitewash world of period pieces, and it injected fun back into the period piece. And Nicola Coughlan just became an absolute star. I think she had this force of goodwill from Derry Girls, and we knew how much everybody loved her from that, but then just really projected and propelled her right into the limelight. And I think it was just the frothiness that and escapism that people really wanted during the pandemic.
Yeah, but it wouldn't have held its position as it did. It was number one in Netflix. Was it for quite a long? I think it was Squid Games eventually that knocked it off that.
Yeah, I mean, it was streamed 82 million times in its first 4 weeks. And we could say, yes, pandemic viewing. But also we have to say there was this unexpected salaciousness about it.
Yeah.
And it became a word of mouth sensation with people talking, going, this is not your usual boots and bonnet Austin-esque. This is, you know, something a lot more frisky and wild. And I think with people, you know, being intrigued by that, everybody wanted to tune in and see what people were talking about.
It struck me there was a touch of Fleabag meets Regency London. That's kind of the area we're in, because it does not this direct talking to camera necessarily, but a very modern sensibility, modern language, certainly in on top of the period setting.
Definitely. And I think that's what Shonda Rhimes did so well. She just married those two sensibilities together and created something that appealed to a modern audience and a young audience as well, because they were saying, this is not your school time. This is not those books that you've read, those dusty books that you may feel, you know, they don't relate to you. Mm. Like, this is something that you can get involved in. And, you know, it definitely was the romance between Daphne and the Duke of Hastings played a huge part in that, because Reggae Jean-Page just became this global pin-up instantly and was even touted as the next James Bond after just 9 hours of Bridgerton to his name, which is phenomenal.
Yeah, and Daphne and the Duke, as you said, that was the big love story of season one. Where are we in season two?
Yeah, they're gone. It's because it's an anthology show. The days of Daphne and the Duke are over. The central story is now going to revolve. It revolves around the oldest Bridgerton brother, Anthony, who's played by Jonathan Bailey, and it's about his quest for marriage instead. Now, Daphne does stick her head in a couple of times during the series, but there's no more Duke, so don't go looking for him because he's not there.
Yeah, he's off getting ready to play James Bond
exactly.
somewhere.
Probably, yeah.
Well, or some, I'm sure, something similar. Yeah. Well, look, I'll come back to Nicola Coughlan because we have to talk about her, but you've mentioned that essentially it's this kind of, how would you describe the kind of play between Lord Anthony Bridgerton, played by Jonathan Bailey, and Kate Sharma, as played by Simone Ashley?
Yeah, they're the newcomers to the ton. So they are the Sharma family, and the younger sister, Edwina, she's primed for the limelight and she takes to her new surroundings like a duck to water and attracts the attention of Anthony. But her older sister, Kate, who's played by Sex Education's Simone Ashley, she's the surly gatekeeper trying to ward off these unseemly suitors. So it's a little bit, you know, their version of The Taming of the Shrew or 10 Things I Hate About You, because, you know, Anthony wants Edwina and he has her as a sole focus, and but Kate and Anthony are battling every step of the way, and she's very sharp-minded and independent, and obviously there's this love-hate relationship, and as they begin to be thrown together in extreme circumstances, they kind of realise they have more in common than they previously thought, and, you know, feelings arise.
Surely not. The chemistry between the two that hate each other at first sight. Jonathan Bailey as Lord Bridgerton, Simone Ashley as Kate Sharma. She's out for an early morning horse ride when they meet.
Well then. I appreciate your attention, sir, but I assure you I am perfectly safe. Perhaps we pretend this encounter never took place? You allow me to go my way and you go yours.
You worry about being seen.
I worry about meeting strange men at parks at dawn who fail to leave me alone with all of their questions.
Your secret is safe with me. I shall not tell a soul.
How grateful I am.
Losing races to strange women in such parks at dawn. I can only imagine the questions I will be asked.
Is that what that was? A race?
Or was it not?
Does one not need actual competition for a race?
We could say that if we had decided on a finish line together, but alas, we made no such agreement.
Ah, I see you are not one for losing.
I shall have you... In the rare instances it occurs, I have no difficulty in admitting that I've either lost or am in the wrong. Though I'm afraid the same cannot be said for you.
I beg your pardon.
Mayfair is not right ahead. But it's the other way entirely. Not lost, you said?
Good day, sir.
We've not yet been introduced.
I'm afraid that is not possible. Not when I have a victory lap to enjoy.
Ah, I'd say they'll get to meet each other before too long, rather than be introduced properly.
Yeah.
Lord Anthony Bridgerton, played by Jonathan Bailey, and Kate Sharma, played by Simone Ashley there. Struck me, Jan Gannon speaking to us this evening about season two of Bridgerton, struck me listening to that, you know, the speed of delivery is one thing. Obviously, there are a lot of words to get out. It has a touch of a kind of screwball comedy pat to it, you know, the patter has that feel to it, but obviously we're in a very different period. It plays with that comedic kind of sensibility, doesn't it?
It definitely does, but I think they're missing that sharp banter. There is a bit of back and forth, as you heard there, but there's nothing, I didn't find it too engaging, and I think...
Is that a problem?
I think the second season, it's more about longing and yearning and restraint, and if you're expecting the bodice-ripping antics of the previous season, you are going to be disappointed. And I think, you know, there's no real chemistry between them. That's what was missing for me. And I think that's a crime in the world of Bridgerton. I mean, I think what Daphne and the Duke had in the first season is one of those lightning in a bottle moments, and I don't think it will be replicated. And I think there should have been moments of emotional torment and unignited passion, but it felt a little bit too sober and a little bit too somber. And I don't know if Jonathan Bailey is up to the challenge of having been the main focus. Only, I think, is because Anthony is not that interesting of a character, to be honest. He's no Mr. Darcy, put it that way.
Yeah, which is funny, as you were speaking there, and all that unignited passion, that's exactly what was coming into my mind, was Mr. Darcy coming up out of the water, of course.
Yeah, he does fall into a lake at one point, but this is not the Mr. Darcy that we're used to, definitely not.
So, let us talk about Penelope. Yes. Do we know a bit more about her this season than we did in the previous season? Or?
I think so. I mean, for me, it's all about Eloise and Penelope, their friendship. Mm. And I think what is happening is we're seeing Eloise, who I love, who is kind of discovering nascent kind of feminism at the time. And we see her kind of questioning the gossip, the insular gossip that Lady Whistledown kind of trades in.
Explain the Lady Whistledown and Penelope, that relationship and you know, how they kind of work off each other.
Well, this is a spoiler alert.
Let's be careful about what we say. Okay?
We're unmasking her right now. So, yes, we found out at the end of the last season that obviously Nicola Coughlan's character, Penelope Featherington, is doubled as Lady Whistledown, who is writing the gossip columns all about the town itself.
The hint is in pen.
Exactly. So she was the standout of season one, and I think she really showed the versatile nature of herself. And I think, you know, there's not that much impishness quality of her from the last season. She's more questioning herself now and about why is she writing this and what is she writing, and wondering what message she's putting out in the world. And she's becoming more mature and almost herself, thinking, do I want to be known as, you know, the invisible observer all the time, or do I want to get involved in this world that I've mercilessly lampooned?
Yeah, well,
this is
interesting, because I wanted to play a clip that features Nicola Coughlan as Penelope. She's going incognito to the printers.
Yes.
This is to have Lady Whistledown's newsletters secretly printed. Now, if you heard, we listened to the first season, she's very posh, high-pitched accent in the first season. Just listen to what she's doing here. Now, yes, she's pretending to be somebody else, but nevertheless, she's incognito. And just listen to what we get from Nicola Coughlan.
You're new to this arrangement, so I'll say this only once. What my mistress wants, she gets. And for whatever reason, that would be you at the moment. That doesn't make you special, Mr. Harris. Printers in this town are 10 a penny. But there's only one Lady Whistledown, and she could just as easily take her business elsewhere. So it's 18, not a penny more. And the delivery boys need a wage increase. They're the ones running around town while you get to sit here on your lazy arse.
Yes, ma'am.
Then my mistress thanks you for your services.
There you go, Nicola Coughlan as Penelope. Penelope incognito, yes, we do have to say that, but she's sporting the Irish accent there, which gives it a kind of a realism and an edginess that perhaps is very different from the anarchic feel that was there in season one.
Definitely. And I think, you know, because she is maturing, she is one of the most three-dimensional characters in the whole show, and she's just a joy to watch on screen. And as you heard there, her accent work is amazing, and she does that duplicitous character so well, and the guilt that she almost feels, and the shame of trying to hide this from so many people, and, you know, the neck closing in on her essentially this season as well, maybe.
But I'm getting a sense that while we have that realism creeping in and we have this sound of maybe this sense of something a little darker in there, you're missing the bodice-ripping, unignited passion of season one.
Well, I don't want Bridgerton to be relatable. I want it to be the ultimate fantasy. I want it to be escapism. I mean, it's still a lavish chocolate box treat and it looks as stunning as ever, but it's just not all fun and games like it was last season. And it's, you know, there's sobering topics of familial love and familial duty have kind of replaced those giddy thrills. And it's a less lusty Bridgerton, put it that way. And it might leave fans a little bit, more than a little bit frustrated, I think.
Okay, so watch season one again.
Probably.
Okay, less lusty Bridgerton. Don't know how I feel about that. Jen, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us this evening. That's Jen Gannon talking to us about Bridgerton season two, which will be on Netflix from tomorrow. But that is our lot for this Thursday evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Amandine Paso-Devine was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead.